Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. Red Eyes TV. I'm Henrik. Always a pleasure seeing you. Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. Our guest today is Kevin MacDonald. We are going to talk about, well, at least initially, about a recent paper that was published. This is back in January, actually, but it was by an Israeli-based academic journal called Philosophia, if I pronounced that correct. And the title of the paper was "The Default Hypothesis Fails to Explain Jewish Influence." And of course, if you're not familiar with Kevin's work, I think most of you are, but if you're not, he's behind the Occidental Observer, author of Culture of Critique, and many other titles as well. Kevin, welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here, Henry.
Always a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you for taking some time. So let's begin with this then. We talked about this offline a little bit, and just the kind of absurd nature to this, you know, and you know this as well as anybody when it comes to this topic, that the problem is to actually manage to address something, both in a serious but also like in an academic way that people take seriously, because otherwise it just goes down the name-calling route. It goes off into tangents, which is irrelevant to the academic study that you've made of this topic. And, of course, it is taboo, right? We recognize that, and that is for a specific reason. But let me begin with this, Kevin. Let me read the abstract to the paper here real quick. "The role of Jewish activism in the transformative changes that have occurred in the West in recent decades continue to be controversial. Here I respond to several issues putatively related to Jewish influence, particularly the default hypothesis that Jewish IQ and urban residency explain Jewish influence and the role of the Jewish community in enacting the 1965 immigration law in the United States. Other issues include Jewish ethnocentrism and intermarriage, and whether diaspora Jews are hypocritical in their attitudes on immigration to Israel versus the United States." And it continues, "The post-World War II era saw the emergence of a new, substantially Jewish elite in America that exerted influence on a wide range of issues that formed a virtual consensus among Jewish activists and the organized Jewish community, including immigration, civil rights, and the secularization of American culture. Jewish activism in the pro-immigration movement involved intellectual movements denying the importance of race in human affairs, establishing, staffing, and funding anti-restrictionist organizations, recruiting prominent non-Jews to anti-restrictionist organizations, rejecting the ethnic status quo as a goal because of fear of a relatively homogenous white majority, and leadership in Congress and the executive branch." So take us through this a little bit, Kevin, here. Of the paper came about, of course, as a reply to Kofnas, right? The other guy. I know you guys have been going back and forth on Twitter, and there's been debates there. But he published a paper called "The Anti-Jewish Narrative," and then you did this as a reply to that. And it did end up being published, as I said, by this Israeli-based academic journal, Philosophia. So tell us how that came about, and do you know why they accepted it, at least at first, right? And then it was some back and forth.
Yeah, Kofnas's paper came out in like about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. And, you know, my first thought was, because, you know, the first time this happened, when he published an article in 2018, and I made these long replies, but I couldn't get them published anywhere. In the journal that published his article wouldn't consider any reply from me. He had an article in Colette saying the same stuff. This was in 2018. And again, they wouldn't accept a reply from me. There was another one like that. And but this time I just decided, well, I'll just ask. And so I sent an email to Philosophia, or however you pronounce it. And they said, okay, yeah, submit a reply. So I worked on this thing. And it went through two rounds of review. It's an academic paper, and the common thing for academic papers is to send them out to so-called peer review, or to send them out to other professors, and they give their opinions on it. So I went through that. They had some criticisms, and I answered them, and lo and behold, the editor accepted it. And so then it got published on January 1st of this year. And immediately there was a big controversy that came out, and they were going after the editor, saying, how could anybody ever publish this thing? And they said they went crazy about it. And so right now on the website, there's this sort of warning label saying that this paper has gotten very controversial, and so we're going to send it out for further review. So they did send that out, and I got the reviews about 2 weeks ago, and they were extremely hostile, all three of them, three reviews.
Big surprise, yeah.
And they gave me 1 week to reply, and I begged for one more week so I could get a little time on this. And so I sent in my reply last week, about a week ago, and I haven't heard back from them on that. But they were extremely hostile. I mean, just calling me all kinds of names, and I didn't think they have substantive criticism. I mean, the problem with the second round of reviews was they basically didn't have any substantive objections. What they would do is simply rephrase my ideas in a very invidious, you know, negative, crazy sounding way, of conspiracy theory, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw how they rephrased it. Like, this is what Kevin means, or this is what he talks about, you know. Yeah.
And so that, I don't know, we'll see what they do with it.
Yeah.
But, the jury's out on that. But anyway, yeah, the paper itself, Kafka has this idea that IQ, Jews are smarter than the average. And so you expect them to be more common among intellectuals. And that explains why Jews are so influential. And I deny that on a number of grounds. First of all, as I say there, if you look at the activism the main issue really in the paper is the 1965 immigration law, showing, because that's the only issue that really would, you know, defeat the culture critique. It would really be a problem for me if they could get over that. But the other thing is just looking at IQ isn't enough, because your Jews are smart. So I have a little section on it, beginning, oh, where is it? It's like the section, the first section, I guess, where I talk about the default hypothesis, and point out that Jewish IQ is simply not enough. That for any level of IQ, there are going to be more white non-Jews than Jews. So you take 120, you know, even though there are more Jews percentage-wise at that, Jews are only 2.5-3% of the population. So for any given level of IQ, there are going to be more white people at that level of IQ. Or you take 130, 140, whatever it is, and you're going to be more white people at that level. So you can't explain Jewish influence simply by saying that Jews are smarter, because they're not really. We you know, there as many, there are more white European Americans who have equally high IQ for any level you want to take for IQ. So that just doesn't explain it. I've got other points there that oftentimes that just really angered a lot of the reviewers, especially in the second round there, that I would say that these Jewish movements would recruit non-Jews as a sort of window dressing. You know, I use the term window dressing actually in Culture of Critique in chapter 3, and I have specific examples of that. And I was actually an example of that back when I was a student. They had a big anti-war rally. I was on the left. I knew all these Jewish guys, roommates and the whole thing. And they asked me to give a talk on how this guy from a small town in Wisconsin came to be, you know, involved in the anti-war movement. And I was there to be sort of the goy who had his head screwed on, right?
Right.
And was become a leftist. So anyway,
because usually I hear this, Kevin, that it's like, well, you know, if Jews were, you know, influential and stuff, they would be, you know, the president, or, you know, like kind of topical things like that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But as an example, you know, you just break down, because in our day and age, right, we're super obsessed, or not us, but like the culture in general, unfortunately. Yeah. About percentages and like how many people are represented based on the numbers and stuff. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Now we're getting an overdrive because we're living in an anti-white age. So, for example, despite the fact that blacks are only about 12% of the U.S. population in TV, media, advertisements and stuff, they're like way overrepresented, right? But like, look at something like Biden's cabinet, for example, right? Jews severely overrepresented in Biden's cabinet, 1% of the population, but about 50%. Of the cabinet. I think one or two have quit, but there's some new ones that come in and stuff, right? that's still like, okay, well, why is there such an overrepresentation then if everything is supposed to be, you know, according to how the number parse out, the percentages, right? How do you explain, just because you don't have a president doesn't mean you don't have influential and powerful people in positions of power that can advocate, whether that be for themselves as a group or whether this for a specific, you know, political objective, right?
Yes, right. Yeah, the fact is Jews are wildly overrepresented in pretty much any position of real power in this country. If you look at the media, massive overrepresentation. You look at the academic world, and I have another paper on that, which I actually reference in this paper. And what I argue there is that that Jews are were, especially in the 1960s, came to the fore in the academic world, and they were much to the left of the average professor at that time. But that's exactly the time when the rise of Jews in the academic world, especially in the most elite colleges, like the Ivy League universities, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, all of them. The academic world is a top-down institution. You know, the professors at Harvard had much more influence than professors down the line. In fact, the professors at Harvard and other Ivy League schools, they train, you know, graduate students in these other areas. Their PhD students go to Berkeley or University of Wisconsin or University of Michigan or something like that. And then at the University of Wisconsin, those graduate students go down to the lower level, the Wisconsin State University or California State University, whatever. And so it trickles down like that. And so academic world is very hierarchical. And so when you take over the top level, you sort of got it under control. And of course, during the 1960s was the time when you established all these ethnic studies departments, when sociology became, you know, it was liberal, but then it became radical, you know, and it started being really influenced by Marx. I was in philosophy. You could see the transition at the time. I was an undergraduate in philosophy, and I went to graduate school in philosophy, and I actually talk about, I talked about that in an article I wrote that, you know, you could see the transformation of the department. That almost all the hires, the young professors that were hired were Jews, and the chairman of the department was Jewish. And it was really an interesting sociological thing. And then I'll just never forget watching one of these older, you know, non-Jewish guys who had just retired, you know, and he's at the medical center and probably, you know, not in good health and everything. And I just sort of felt sorry, but it was like the changing of the guard.
Right. Yeah.
And now you had these young Jews and they were all on the left and they were radical and they were, you know, they came from the best institutions. Just like I was saying, you know, if you're an Oxford PhD, you go to the University of Wisconsin, you know, as you to be a professor.
So
or Harvard, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can summarize for us, how you think, what you think is possible? How does that work, right? What happened there? If you can, you know, boil that down for newcomers to your work and stuff like that. Like that would just, I guess, get to the essence, both of your paper, of course, but also kind of the main study that you've done over the years, right? So how do we explain it, Kevin?
How do we explain? Sorry,
basically, how do we explain that so many Jews ended up in the position that they did? Right, it's obviously down to the thing of ethnic interest, right? That they have a group interest here, which is about advancing their own group and their own interest of the group, right?
That's right. I mean, and the whole thesis of cultural critique is that, you know, IQ is important, and they are smarter, you know, on average, but only on average. And again, if you look at the numbers, they're far more non-Jews than Jews at an IQ, say, of over 140. I came up like 7-1. So you can't explain this to Jewish by IQ, but you can certainly start to explain it with ethnic networking. And what that means is that you promote other Jews and you cite them. You view them as leaders and gurus. So one of the ideas in a culture critique is what I call the guru phenomena, where you have a guru like Freud or Franz Boas or Horkheimer, the Frankfurt School, These people were you know, central figures that were looked up to and idolized. Trotsky's a good example. And they were, then seen as by other Jewish intellectuals or political activists as this, they would sort of gather around and soak up his wisdom. And so there was all this mutual reinforcement, mutual ethnic networking, mutual patting on the back.
Right, yeah.
And mutual hiring, you know. So you could see that in Wisconsin. You know, once the Jews got in there, they started hiring their own people. And pretty soon the whole department's transformed. And that sort of writ large is what happened, I think, to the academic establishment. But then when it comes to media, it's a little different because there, so much of it involves ownership. But even in the 1930s, Jews had a very disproportionate ownership of media. You know, the New York Times, the NBC broadcasting, and CBS then became Jewish, and all the big networks, so the ABC, so that by the 1950s, I mentioned this in the paper, the 1950s, all the big, all the television networks when I grew up, we were three networks exactly. We didn't have cable or any of that stuff. All three were owned by Jews. And there was a big push after World War II by Frankfurt School people. There's a great paper by Andrew Joyce about this. I mean, something I overlooked pretty much. But he got into how these Jewish activists that were associated with the Frankfurt School, I definitely recognize their names. But what they got into was really influencing the media. And the basic message was, you know, race does not exist. It was the whole Boasi and anthropology that race does not exist, that the worst thing in the world is white people who are ethnocentric. And if you are ethnocentric, it's a sign of some kind of pathology. You know, you had bad parent-child relationships. You are inadequate personality-wise. You're envious of other people. There are all kinds of explanations that these people came up with. And they're all nonsense. They're not based on any kind of data, really. But they, you know, they satisfy Jewish interests. And the entire Jewish community was much to the left. And even, you know, whatever occupation, you know, Jewish businessmen tend not to be as radical as Jewish sociology professors or something. But they are to the left of non-Jewish business people. And there's a big push now for your sort of social responsibility in business. And these, you know, people like the guy, you know, I guess named Larry Fink from Blackstone.
BlackRock, yeah, BlackRock.
Yeah, and Mark Benioff, Salesforce. They're like big push for social responsibility in business. And so, you know, the fact is now, I mean, when I was growing up, businesses tend to be conservative to the right of the people as a whole. But business has really been another area that's been taken over by the left. And so you have big corporations, Coca-Cola, all those, but all the search and big internet companies, social media, all on the left. Walt Disney was, when I was growing up, was run by Walt Disney, and he was very conservative. He was probably an anti-Semite because the Jews tried to take away his company many times.
Right, yeah.
But after he died, guess what? They ended up with it. And it's been run by Jews for a long time. And, you know, it's very liberal. And now you look at Jewish at the movies and stuff that Disney puts out. They have some for children and some for adults and all that. But even the movies, the cartoons directed at children are very much on the left when it comes to race and white privilege and, you know, centering black people and all that kind of stuff. So, our world has been transformed, and we have to understand that. And what really gets me is that some of the caucus comes along and, oh, it's IQ, you know, and that sort of explains it. I heard other people say, oh, it's modernism. Oh, yeah, right. I mean, the world's been into a modernist state where we had industrial cars, pretty advanced technology, even by say 1940, when you had fascism in Europe, and you had a very different culture in America, and very different attitudes. I mean, you have to remember, America did pass the 1924 immigration law that was very much biased towards Northwestern Europe. It was supposed to reflect the population, the percentages of the population as they existed in 1920 at first, and then went down to 1890. So, when you think about the population of the United States in 1890, it was overwhelmingly Northern European.
Yeah.
They did not want, certainly there was some concern about Italian immigrants because they were different. They tended to come from the south of Italy. And that's where you see the mafia and all this sort of familism, that really is not good. And it's very different from Northern Europe. That's a big thesis in my book on Western family structure and everything. But the big problem really was Eastern European Jews. They came from Poland and other areas in Eastern Europe, and they were radicals. They were either, especially, Marxists, when the Soviet Union was established in 1917, they were entirely on board. Almost the entire American Jewish community was entirely on board with the Bolshevik Revolution. And, it's no surprise that the atrocities, the horrible, the mass murders and torture and everything else that happened in the first decades of the Soviet Union was completely covered up in the American media. These people had never heard about it. Covered up, and the far left continued with the Jewish community. If you look in the 1950s, I grew up in the 1950s, and you think of it as this sort of golden age, and it sort of was for me growing up because it was a really nice, peaceful scene. But under the surface, there was this massive cultural battle going on, and Joel McCarthy, famously, holding these hearings in Washington. He was a senator from Wisconsin, 20 miles down the road from where I live. And he had these hearings to expose the communists in the State Department and other areas of government. And a high percentage of the people he brought before his committee were Jews. And the American Jewish community was very uptight about it because they were so overrepresented. And so there was, at that time, the American Jewish community was all in favor of free speech. Well, things have changed since then. Now the American Jewish community is entirely on the board of censorship. Anything they don't like, which means anything like sorts of things that we would look.
Yeah, it's completely changed the attitudes and the environment. And again, it was just free speech and all that. It was just used as long as they could take control and dominate. Then it's like it's not, democracy is not so great anymore. We have to do all these things.
Exactly.
To change it.
There are no principles here.
No,
it's just interest.
It's because it's about winning. It's not about being principled.
It's about winning.
No.
It's about their interests and nothing more. And people don't get that. I think a lot of white people really are principled. And you see these conservatives, they're principled to a fault.
To a fault, to
a Korean fault.
Yeah.
They have principles of, democracy, freedom, all these things that they mouth all the time. And they don't seem to care about the consequences, in the real world, like immigration. They don't seem to care or be aware that this is going to submerge the Republican Party. So there's going to be no hope for real conservatism in the future, anything like it was, 50 years ago, with this immigration. And, but they don't care. It's like a principle. Or else it's just profits. But yeah, these Jewish organizations have no principles. And it's really, if you look at Jewish ethics, it's the same sort of thing. It's whatever's good for Jews. There are no general principles that apply both to Jews and non-Jews. Despite what you read on Wikipedia, by the way, they have a page on Jewish ethics, and it's like fantasy land. If you look at actual Jewish writing on ethics over the centuries, it made a big difference if you killed, if a Jew killed a goy or a non-Jew versus killing a Jew, or stole from a non-Jew versus a Jew, had a slave who was a Jew versus a non, anything like that.
Yeah, so Kevin, before we continue there, I want to sneak in this real quick because it's a perfect, actually, the perfect timing. The fact that you brought up BlackRock, and I want to play a clip actually with Larry Fink here now too. But you talked basically about the neoliberal capitalist world, right? How they've joined forces with all the, you know, this social justice, right? That's the boiled down term they use for it. Social justice.
Or
we could call it anti-white. We know what's going on. But, you know, it's a BlackRock, right? It's literally their... passing the mark now. They're the first company in the history of the world that's going to oversee or manage, I think, about $10 trillion, right? They're like an asset management company. They're a holding company, right? They handle other people's. But I saw an interesting clip the other day too, by the way. Apparently the government hires them for regulation. They have insight into specific information that other banks and financial services don't have. They came out of nowhere, and it used to be Goldman Sachs, but BlackRock just kind of surpassed them all of a sudden. Like, they came out of nowhere, at least as far as I'm concerned, right? But showing a screenshot here, right? BlackRock, $10 million to support the Black Lives Matter movement, right? Of course, Amazon did the same, Goldman Sachs, right? And you have... much more of some of the other companies as well, but this is not strange, right? Here's even a screenshot from what BlackRock had on their website, I believe, right? Social impact. This is just what you mentioned here. In February, we established the BlackRock Foundation to augment our efforts to promote a more inclusive and sustainable economy. Through our focus on financial security for vulnerable communities, we aim to bring visibility and increased resources to support the upward mobility of Black and Latinx communities. Our $10 million plan include, and then they went on from there, right? But isn't this fascinating how this capitalist corporation all of a sudden joins forces with the likes of not only the World Economic Forum, but the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, right? Some people call this Agenda 2030, but there's a number of names, right? But something, have you heard of ESG, Environment, Social, and Governance? It's this new kind of stakeholder capitalist system. And it looks like, Kevin, that it doesn't matter what big company you go to, they're all aboard on this. And it seems even at some points they're perfectly willing to put the aspect of profit to the side to start inflicting change in a direction which I think a lot of people wouldn't agree to. But again, keep in mind, these are unelected people, right? They're taking their massive wealth and power and influence and just steamrolling over, if you will, the democratic process, right?
Yeah. And besides donating money, they can punish companies that don't go along. Like, you can imagine a company holds out. Pretty soon, you know, BlackRock divests from some of their, they got all these investment funds, and, they might have a harder time on Wall Street getting loans and stock offerings and all kinds of things. The supply lines, people might stop using them, you know, because I think that's what's happened here, is that you've had a critical mass and now it's moving fast forward, putting incredible amounts of money and so much corruption. I mean, they've exposed a number of these Black Lives Matter people taking money, and just nobody knows where the money went. You know, it's like millions and millions of dollars that they've given.
Four or five houses, right? In white neighborhoods, of course. They're buying houses, right? Just squandering the money, or running with it, or whatever, right? But listen to this. Listen to this clip here. Here's Larry Fink.
Well, behaviors are going to have to change, and this is one thing we're asking companies. You have to force behaviors, and at BlackRock, we are forcing behaviors.
There you go. We have to force behavior. Wonder what that means. And I mean, they're gobbling up everything. If you look at basically any major corporation today, there's two, I think they're just called holding companies, right? It's BlackRock is usually number one on that list. And it doesn't matter if it's Pepsi or Coca-Cola or whether it's Pfizer or Moderna, right? They're up there. And then it's, Vanguard number two. And then usually number three might be State Street. Or you get, what's his name again? Is it Warren Buffett's? I forget what his firm is called now, but it's usually those four, right? But my point is here, they just have massive influence over the whole business sector and the whole capitalist neoliberal system, you know?
What they do is they buy up large blocks of stock in a particular company. Then they have voting rights, and then they can go to the shareholders meeting and they can put pressure. Any activist investor that has a significant stake in a company can be heard. I mean, you don't have to have 50%. Even a few percent is enough to make you heard. I mean, Carl Icahn, for example, famously is an activist investor. He'll buy a whole lot of stock and then he'll say, like, we got to get rid of this management team, or you have a lot of power. And BlackRock has huge resources. They can do this. And, so if a company is not on board with this stuff, they better get on board. And, Fink was saying, they don't have any problems with coercion. It's almost like their really ideal model is a Chinese model where you have top down total government control, surveillance everywhere. But you do have a wealthy oligarchic elite. And I really think that's what they're aiming for. An oligarchic globalist elite that is able to establish a surveillance state and just radically curtail the freedoms of ordinary people.
Yes, absolutely. It's the ESG thing, and again, it's like, it's kind of interchangeable. You know, you have the Bank of International Settlements to a certain degree pushing this. You have the World Economic Forum. And then, of course, you have other, United Nations, as I mentioned, the Sustainable Development Goals or Agenda 2030, right? But it's kind of like a social credit score for the business world. And you know what I think the root of this is? I think the root of it is that as they previously chose the democratic, method or whatever you want to call that strategy, right? Because I think to a certain extent, they had control of information. They could manipulate. I mean, what does it matter if you have a democracy if everyone is just led around the nose by, television or whatever? It doesn't matter, right? But I think the reality is they kind of lost this control at some point, and things started moving and happening. And Trump was a big, indicator of this. But you had Salvini in Italy, you had Orban in Hungary, you had, there's a couple of parties like this in Germany, in Holland, in Netherlands, in Sweden, of course, right? And I think they slowly began to realize we can't count on these people to do our bidding. We have to start going to the business world. We have to start getting these massive, CEOs aboard. And we have to build the Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum guy, talks about stakeholder capitalism. And it's this kind of integrated system where basically every company is interdependent on each other. And they're signed up to this, right, through the UN Sustainable Development Goals or the ESGs under the same kind of globalist institution. They're saying, if you don't have, if you don't have enough non-white people working for you, you're going to get a lower score, and you're not going to be part of that grid work of all the other corporations. You can go to them and for services or for materials. So it's like the same. They're freezing out those who are refusing to comply. That's what I think this is.
Yeah, that's what's going to be.
Yeah,
absolutely.
ESG, environmental, social, and governance, right, or governance. Under environment, we know where that's going, climate change strategy, biodiversity, carbon intensity, which of course is the carbon kind of, carbon has become an enemy now all of a sudden, and they're going to use that as a kind of a value point or a currency, it seems like, in the future. And then on the social, it says equal opportunities, freedom of association, I wish, health and safety, human rights, customers, production, blah, 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 child labor. But under that banner is also like diversity, equity, what are you doing to make sure that there's not too many white people in your corporation and things like that. So it's like a whole neoliberal capitalist way of enforcing these very, very radical, left-wing ideas that you've been talking about for such a long time, but utilizing this in the business world. It's a completely new strategy in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. And I certainly resonate with what you said before, that Trump and the populist parties, is like in Hungary, just scared the hell out of these people. They just, that was a total wake-up call because Trump was very popular. I mean, Trump screwed up in a lot of ways, but he was also under attack his entire presidency, like no other president has ever been. And there's never been such a incredible wall-to-wall full-court press assault on a president as they did. They tried to impeach him repeatedly, and And, you know, one scandal, hoax actually, after another. It was an amazing phenomenon. So, yeah, they are terror. They want to seal the deal. And I think COVID was the best thing that ever happened to them because they managed to change all the voting laws and everything else and get fear into the hearts of everyone. And now, you know, the war in Ukraine is one crisis after another.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, exactly. I guess we can segue over to that a little bit. It's pretty crazy, but it's like Putin have actually given these people everything they want in a way. They've managed to. I mean, NATO has a new purpose now. They're kind of like, for 70 years, what were they? Sure, they were expanding, but it's like, what do you need them for? What are they doing, right? Even look, Trump, right? Didn't he say we need not to pay so much money to NATO? And he, I guess, forced other countries to pay, you know, unfortunately, European ones, which is, you know, whatever. But, you know, the point stands, right? What are we doing here? And even here's a globalist from Sweden here, Carl Bildt. You might remember him. He was the head of the moderate party, right? Our conservatives for a while. He's been hanging around on the Bilderberg meetings. He's going to all these big globalist meetings and stuff. And he said this on Twitter yesterday, actually this earlier today then. It's going to be a unique summit of summits in Brussels today. And that's where Biden is currently right now. He's speaking there and many other people, right? It says it's a NATO summit, an EU summit, and a G7 summit. I think that's a first when it comes to these things. President Putin, here's the kicker, right, has managed to bring the democratic world together in a unique way with his aggression. In other words, Putin is giving them exactly what they want, Kevin. Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Now Putin has justified their existence, all these groups in a way, right?
The fact is that the NATO was an anachronism after 1991. They really didn't need it anymore. And I just tweeted this thing. There's an article that Putin gave interviews in 2000, the end of 2000, 2000, early 2001, saying that he would like to join NATO. And he said that Russia's part of the West and all that. Well, that was rebuffed. And you could see that this American foreign policy establishment never gave up that hostility. And, you know, when Putin came in and got rid of those oligarchs, he took over real control, whereas Yeltsin was completely under the thumb of these oligarchs who ran the media and really ran Russia and just stole all the wealth and became billionaires and all that. It was horrible. And then, you know, they invited Ukraine to be part. They kept expanding and expanding. Every time it happened, Russia would object. And then they said that Ukraine could be part. Well, we're right on the border, big country. And 2014, with the Maidan uprising, totally CIA operation, neocons, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a neocon organization, Victoria Nuland famously, and of course they're freaked out by that.
Yeah,
they changed the government. You had a government that was de facto neutral. It wasn't hostile to the West. Wasn't hostile to Russia, and they were doing the right thing. But then this, so it's just horrible what's happened here.
They're giving him it fits perfectly, you know, into the bigger picture. And we'll talk more a little bit later here, but like what some of the consequences is here. And of course now, you know, again, so-called conspiracy theorists, or whatever you're going to say, talked about this a while ago, even as a result of the COVID measures, right? But now the upper elites are beginning to address these issues openly as well. Even Biden today, in fact, talked about food shortages as a consequence of the Ukraine-Russia war. It's, of course, very convenient, as I said, because the ball has been rolling for a long time. But there is an exacerbated problem as something I think will come down the pipes. But before we get in there, you tweeted out an article as well, and I want to try to get to this, because a lot of people are going back and forth, and I'm not sure what's going on in Russia. I'm not sure what's going on with Putin. Is he controlled by some of the some of the oligarchs that wasn't kicked out? Is he critical overall of these oligarchs, of Jewish influence? What's going? I'm reading both things at the same time, and we can show a couple of things that shows it. But you tweeted out this one from Tablet Magazine: the fate of Putin's Jewish oligarchs, right? Because back in, as you said, when he initially took control, there was a number of them, that were kicked out, right? We were talking about Boris Berezovsky. He ended up dying in London, right? But he was like, you know, going between Tel Aviv and London and basically spent most of his fortune and the rest of his life trying to undermine Putin. Together with people like Alex Goldfarb, they sponsored the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, right? Coup attempt after coup attempt, all these things. You had other people too, Abrahamovich. You had, Khodorkovsky. I think he was in jail for some time, right? Are there some others, Kevin, as well that you're aware of that are still there now? That
there are this Mikhail Fridman for one. He's Jewish, but I think what happened here is that when Putin came in, he wanted to consolidate power. He didn't want to be controlled by these oligarchs, and there's a big difference there. So he got rid of Khodorkovsky, because he was big time involved in politics, got rid of Guzinski, who had a big position in Russian media and was very pro Yeltsin and all of that. And, you know, these billionaires were not apolitical. They were totally involved in Russian politics. And, you know, it was very much like what we have in this country, where the media is on one side and pushing certain things. And you wouldn't call it a democracy, but they're giving us some messages and filtering it and everything. And I really do believe that Putin consolidated power, and that the tablet article is quite right. It fits right well also with an article we posted on Occidental Observer simultaneously, almost, by this guy Roloslavsky, who lives in Eastern Europe and is a new writer for us. But he, you know, said the same thing. That Putin is in control in Russia. And it's quite the opposite of what's going on in Ukraine, where Zelensky is bought and paid for by this Jewish oligarch, Kolomoisky. And he's, you know, Zelensky's got millions of dollars from this guy. Zelensky was a TV actor. He was a comedian. And he was nothing. And so then all of a sudden this Kolomoisky guy, and there he is, puts him in a TV show where he's a president, and then they
Servant of the People. That was the title of the show.
Yeah, and he runs for president again, an anti-corruption campaign, if you can believe it.
Yeah,
Kolomoisky is so corrupt; it's unreal. He was involved. He was involved in the same gas company that Hunter Biden got all his money from. He's got operations in Miami and all this stuff, offshore accounts, complete sleazeball. And of course, he's Jewish. So President Zelensky just bought and paid for. He's a boy. You can never say that about Putin. Putin runs Russia. And anybody, including an oligarch, who gets on the wrong side of him, better watch out. He runs the place. And you can say, well, it's not a democracy. Yeah, it's not. But neither is Ukraine, really. You know, it's an oligarchy, and it's run by these oligarchs. And Ukraine has a reputation as being the most corrupt country in Europe.
Yeah.
And it still is. And
thanks to the people meddling in it, too, right?
Yeah. And democracy, you know, Zelensky just abolished all political parties that are opposed to him, consolidated the media into one big media that they have one message.
Yep.
But that's democracy?
Yep. Freedom.
You know, what we're fighting for over there?
They're fighting for their freedom, right? And then they've had like some of the most, I think even now, these are, you know, kind of maybe not side issues, but I just saw here in passing that it's like, the COVID thing have been crazy too in Ukraine. It's almost like the U.S. is using the Ukraine as a playground, as a testing ground, right? The whole thing with the bio labs, right? There's in-depth research on that alone, but those are mostly, you know, they were Pentagon funded at least. Some of them were even operated. They were operated by U.S. diplomats and stuff. They did the same thing in Georgia, right? All this crazy stuff, but it's been so corrupt there. And there's so many American, you know, that have nestled their way in there, and they're using it as kind of like a slush fund, I guess, for the lack of a better term, right? Look at Hunter Biden, right? He gets in there, he gets on the board of Burisma, right? He's like $85,000 a month or whatever the hell it was for literally doing nothing, and it gets worse, right? All these companies are in there, and they're meddling, and they're ensuring kind of that Ukraine never really gets up on its feet and sorts things out. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and so they, you know, but then Joe Biden goes over to Ukraine and says that if they don't get, stop this prosecution, this investigation and
That's
criminal
right.
investigation
yeah.
of this gas company, they'll withhold $1 billion in aid. Biden is up to his eyeballs in this corruption. And it's a possibility that the fact that the New York Times finally publicized this, that those emails and the stuff on that laptop is authentic, you wonder what's going on here. Maybe they understand that Biden isn't working. He's very unpopular. But I don't know what we're going to do about Kamala Harris, who's the weakest vice president in history, and everybody says she's just doing a horrible job. But there was an article we had on Occidental Observer right around the same time, that article from Tablet by Roloslavsky, and he points out this recent Bloomberg article, which is Jewish oligarch Mikhail Friedman lamenting the fact that sanctions were imposed on him and his friends. And, with the Biden sanctions, that's one of the recent things they did. And amounted to him pleading for Washington to relent, arguing that neither he nor his friends have any real pull or power over Putin. Without information indicating anything to the contrary, we may as well take his words at face value. I believe that.
Yeah.
That Putin's position is strong and consolidated. And nobody can really get in his way. And if you do, you're going to be, you're going to be in trouble, and he'll probably confiscate your assets. He doesn't mind Jews being rich, really wealthy, but he doesn't want them to be messing in politics unless they agree with him.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too, right? And again, that's why I'm getting like conflicting information, and maybe it's, maybe we're looking at this from a different view than he does. Obviously, he's a politician. He knows how to play politics to a certain extent. He's at times, despite the Westwood denials, of course, but he's diplomatic to a certain extent. And as you said, it's not that he's like, out to get Jews or something like that. I mean, obviously not, right? I mean, there's people in there. And again, let's show a couple of headlines as a way to kind of get that point of view of like contradiction, right? He said things like this, right? This is an article a while ago, right? Putin, first Soviet government was mostly Jewish. What is that, right? There's other articles like this where, and of course the West would say, well, this, look at how anti-Semitic Putin is. He's literally Hitler, right? Putin jokes about Jews and money during visit to Crimea. He said he cracked a joke about Jews and money visiting to Crimea. I said, oh, so the Jews have problems with finances? He answered, to laughter. Such a thing could only happen in Crimea, right? There's things like that, which is kind of, it's more funny, right? But the West takes this very seriously, and this is a big problem and big issue. But then at the same time, people that are like maybe looking to Putin or something for like, oh, he's ensuring that there's no Jewish ethnic interest in the country. That's obviously not correct either. Here is another compilation of some headlines that people had, right? How he's targeting, actually, he's targeting nationalist groups. He's going after, the so-called far right in Russia, right? They're a very multicultural country. I mean, they have a lot of different ethnic groups. They're a federation. They're very proud of that fact, right? Here's Al Jazeera. The death of the Russian far right. The Jerusalem Post. Putin, not remotely anti-Semitic, says Russia's chief rabbi. The Jewish Daily Forge that Holocaust deniers in Russia now face 5 years in prison. Jerusalem Post, at Putin's side, an army of Jewish billionaires. And that's from 2012, so not that long ago, 10 years ago. And then Lauder, of course, Russia's fight against anti-Semitism isn't just good for Jews, it's good for Russia as well. And then WorldNet Daily says the day Putin prayed for rebuilding the temple, right? So it's not as squared away and as easily like just say, oh, it's this or that, as you said. But it seems to be, and I guess I'm trying to be as just charitable and genuine as like accurate, I guess that's the best term as possible. And it's like he seems to be very proud of his multicultural, federation of sorts. I've heard him mention that many times in talks, and and he thinks he's, fighting, Nazism in Ukraine. And of course, you have assets of that. So, I'm not trying to look down on that, but it's obviously not the biggest problem if you have Washington sponsoring everything, right? The liberal world order of the West sponsoring you. Your problem is not Nazis. They hunt Nazis in the West, so they're not Nazis taking over everything and running the show in Ukraine. But my point is, he genuinely seems like, as long as you don't like are engaging in like criminal behavior that undermines the Russian Federation, he seems to be somewhat okay. He doesn't care what ethnic group it is. That's what I'm getting to. What do you think of this, Kevin?
Well, again, I think it's hard to really get an inside view of all that. Again, this writer, Rollo Slavsky, has written now, well, I posted already 6 articles of his. He's got one called The State of Opposition Nationalist Politics in Russia. And basically what he says is that things have been changing recently and that the nationalist right doesn't really, you know, have much of a conflict now with Putin, that Putin has changed in their direction enough to mollify them. So I thought this was very interesting. I can't really, you know, I vouch that this is absolute truth, but this guy really seems to understand what's going on the ground in Russia. I understand that in the past, these Russian nationalists said they had a big problem with Putin, but that is not so much the case anymore, if at all.
No, exactly. I'm trying to find that article as well. But it's a very interesting dynamic. And, of course, there's big fights in the West over this. Do you take the Ukrainian side? Do you take the Russian side? And some people say, oh, Putin is great. Russia's going to fix everything. And I don't believe in that. And then at the same time, it's like I don't want anything bad to happen to Ukraine or Ukrainians. Obviously not. But it's clear to me at this point that they're being used as a cannon fodder in this battle. Yeah. And I mean, even Liam Panetta the other day, the former, I think it's ex-CIA, right? He just literally said, like, whatever people say, this is a proxy war. You have massive amounts of funds. Biden gave them $15 billion the other day. $1 billion of that was arms, weapons, all kinds of things, right? You have foreign mercenaries coming to the country, encouraged to come to the country. And just this massive hypnosis campaign, essentially, mind control campaign in the West, to just no matter what, like Ukraine number one, that's it. You know, like every liberal and left wing lunatic in the West now is like super gung ho about like, you know, our people in Ukraine, the people in Ukraine and their borders and their freedom and their nationalism. It's quite something, isn't it?
It's pathetic.
Yeah,
I really do, and that's why I really hope Russia wins this, at least gets a good settlement. Where they are able to insist that Ukraine not be part of NATO, that and at least get the Donbass and Crimea formalized, because I really do think that this is the globalist elites on one side and pushing for Ukraine and against really Russia and China together now. You know, China's been backing Russia. And I think it's an interesting sign that they see they don't want, you know, this Western hegemony that has been going on since World War II, and really long before that. But I think that they have decided that, you know, they want, you know, a bipolar world here, at least where you have other centers of power. And I think that's why the West is putting up such a strong fight. They see this as Armageddon here. They don't want to lose this because if they do, you know, it's going to be a huge setback for globalism. Some people have already said that it's a huge setback for globalism anyway. But I think if Putin really comes out of this looking good, and he may well, if he gets what he wants, I do think that globalism would take a huge hit. This is an expression of Russian nationalism. It's a rejection of the West, and it's really a wake up call that this is not going to be a unipolar world anymore. I mean, that's what happened in 1991 when the Soviet Union died. Basically, immediately these neocons in the United States said, "Look, unipolar world. We are the boss. We can run things." So what do you have? War after war. In the Middle East and everywhere else, the Russian embassies in the UK and Ukraine, everywhere else, they were tweeting this stuff today, where you had the pictures of American presidents like Clinton, the Bush Senior, Bush Junior, and all that, and not Trump, by the way, but Obama was in there, and then saying, you know, five wars and 6 million dead and all that, and all in the name of democracy and non-interventionism. It's a joke. That's the Russian point of view, that America has been a great intervening all over the place.
Yeah.
And causing havoc and death and destruction. Think what happened to Iraq. I mean, forget about the American casualties, which were, large, thousands. But Iraqis lost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people here.
Oh, yeah. Madeleine Albright, you just passed away, right? The former U.S. Secretary of State said, remember that clip from 60 Minutes? It's worth it. 500,000 Iraqi kids. And look at the waves of migration that's come in the wake of these conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa, too.
Yeah. A good example is Gaddafi with Libya.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton is cackling about how wonderful that was. And we came, he died, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, when the result is total political chaos in Libya. You have these warring factions. I don't think they've solved it yet. And then you've got migration coming up from Africa that Libya used to stop. They don't do it anymore. So they got slave markets and the whole crazy thing. Gaddafi was good in a lot of ways. And it was crazy for NATO at the behest of Hillary Clinton was really the prime mover of that. But that's it. You know, these liberals are, you know, you think of liberals, not anti-war people. They're not anti-war people.
No.
They want wars that serve their interests.
Exactly. And again, I mean, it's like Biden said, right? This is a, you know, after the, in his speech there, he said after the Second World War, there was a formulation of a liberal world order, and all these countries are beginning to kind of, you know, homogenize under this banner and stuff. And now they're saying they're kind of losing control of this. And look, I'm not saying, and I personally don't think that it will be any better for white people if Russia teams up with China and India and a bunch of Asian countries and exerts more dominance than the U.S. Look, it's been bad enough under U.S. control. But we have no idea what's going to happen if we truly go into like the abyss in terms of economic collapse. And let's assume that they make it somehow over there, right? Russian alliance, you have the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, with Israel trying to kind of, right now Israel's trying to play this in-between game. They haven't been quite outspoken about being pro-Ukraine or pro-Russia. They've been asked to mediate many, many, many times, right? But the point is, it's like a new alignment, or new, I guess, a new Cold War, I guess. That's the best term. A new Cold War of sorts is opening up, right?
It would probably produce that, if that's right. And I think if the West, you see, I just can't want the West to win, because what we're about is multiculturalism. We're massive immigration, anti-white politics. I just can't get behind it. And no, I know they're nationalists in Ukraine. I love them, and I see why they do what they do. But I see it from our point of view, as someone who lives in the West. And if the West wins this, they're just going to clamp down all the harder, and so the whole anti-white revolution is going to go faster and faster. And
yeah, I kind of say rational, normal, sensible people need to take control of the West again.
Yeah,
and
we
need to be in a position where we're still influential, but on good terms. We should trade with Russia. Look, and this
absolutely.
We'll get into this in the second party. We're going to take a break here now. But again, like this absolute lunacy from Biden and from these European leaders who are like shooting themselves in the foot. You're cutting yourself off from oil and gas and hydrocarbons. What are you going to do? Fertilizer now, all the grain supply. Like, this will be a disaster. And again, I think it's by design. But we'll talk more about that in a second, Kevin. We're going to take just a quick break here. You can follow Kevin MacDonald on Twitter, T-O-O Edit, right, for editor. And that's, of course, The Occidental Observer. Check that out. That's a great publication. And then, of course, you have The Occidental Quarterly as well. Still printing that, Kevin. Is there a digital version of that, or is it just a hard copy version?
It's hard copy, and it's online. And a hard copy subscription is $60 a year. Online is $30. So anybody can afford it, really. And we just put out the spring issue. Just put it in the Just completed it.
Awesome. The Occidental Quarterly, of course, check that out. There's links from Occidental Observer. And again, the website for that is theoccidentalobserver.net. Definitely check it out. Make sure you follow. Make sure you support Kevin's work. We'll take just a quick break here. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be right back with Kevin. Join us in the second part, ladies and gentlemen, as we continue with Kevin MacDonald at RedIceMembers.com for a very fascinating part two. We're going to go deeper into the major consequences of some of these policies now that we're seeing because of sanctions, because of import-export restrictions and these kinds of things, and the deeper crisis, right? These are very important topics because they're right at the forefront, and they might drastically change how we live, not only within the scope of 6 months, we don't know, a year, 2 years out, maybe longer. We do not know how these things are going to be resolved. We don't know if we have the means and capability in many Western nations to kind of make up for the things that might be lost as a consequence of the poor decision-making that led to this schism between, well, essentially Russia and the West, but in the continuation you have a increasing side on the East being formed with India and China, of course, kind of aligning with Russia, Iran, you know, some of these other countries, a new alliance, a kind of a new Cold War of sorts is rising up out of this. And again, a consequence of this, high gas prices, food shortages, fertilizer shortage, and again, these could have massive consequences in a span of very short times. We're going to talk more about that with Kevin MacDonald. We have some other topics lined up as well. We'll talk a little bit more about the crazy anti-whiteness that's still, you know, under, as all of this is ongoing in the West and as we're collapsing. The anti-white nonsense is still continuing to this day. There's a rising crime, of course. These things are never going away. And we're seeing a West in decline. I'm kind of asked the question, well, is this what they want, right? Isn't that one of the goals of the Frankfurt School, is to make the West so corrupt that it stinks? So the question is, people are rooting for the West to collapse. Are they just abiding by these, by this old agenda, essentially, as opposed to advocating maybe for a change in the West? I'm not saying solely political, but at some point, sane, rational, sensible people will have to step up and take responsibility and try to restore our nations to some kind of balance again, or that'll be it, at least in the current configuration. But anyway, that's some of the things we're going to get into with Kevin in the second part, so join us over at redicemembers.com. You can sign up over at subscribestar.com/redice as well. Support us over there. It's only $10 a month. If you sign up for a longer subscription, we have those as well, all the way up to 2 years. It gets cheaper per month. I think it's $6.20 or so per month if you get a 2-year subscription. This helps to support us. We need your support. We need your help to still continue to be here. We need fuel in the tank so we can keep going. Without your support, there will be no Red Ice. Don't leave it up to anyone else. It's up to you to step up and ensure that we can continue. So if you like what we do, consider either signing up for a membership or donating. You can find more about that on redice.tv/donate. It's only with your help that Red Ice can continue. All right, guys, thank you so much again. We'll be back with more soon, but check out the second hour right now then with Kevin MacDonald. Check out all the different methods that we have to sign up. Subscribe Star, Entropy Stream. We have the Cash App. We have an e-check option. We have crypto, and we have a mailing address as well. Keep in mind, guys, that we are banned from several financial services that normal individuals and corporations out there do have access to. So we've been denied access. Why? Because, of course, we are over the target. That's why that happens. So we don't have any big sponsors or angel investors. Actually, in fact, we should, if you feel inclined, definitely step up to the plate. But we appreciate your support. Share the links, share the show, share the videos that we do, because that helps to get the word out as well. Thank you, guys. Part two with Kevin MacDonald is coming up, so we'll see you on the other side.